speaker. Before we get into the formal business of the House, which is all bills and motions, I wanted to rise just to reflect that history was made yesterday on the football field by the senior GFA squad and the under 15 squad in two respects. The first event of note, Speaker, was a fantastic show scored by Lee Castellano, which made out all of Gibraltar have watched on television, and some are lucky enough to watch in person at Hampden Park. In the Euro qualifier, which Gibraltar were playing against Scotland, the Speaker has no doubt that the Castellano goal was actually, in my view, definitely the most beautiful goal of the match. And I'm sure that the whole House will want to join me in congratulating Lee Castellano for the fantastic achievement that the goal represents as our first in a competitive international competition. Moreover, at the level of our younger players in the under 16, we can see that the next generation of Gibraltarian footballers are also achieving greatly. As their more senior brethren had already done, they yesterday beat Malta by 2 goals. They were playing in the GFA's first ever youth development tournament being held this weekend in Gibraltar. And Mr. Speaker, I know that also in Gibraltar, for the tournament of the teams from Macedonia and San Marino. I'm delighted to welcome Malta, Macedonia, and San Marino teams to Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, and I warmly congratulate all of our senior and under 16 squad and their coaching and training staff on behalf, no doubt, of the whole Parliament. Mr. Speaker, the GFA made the beautiful game carry our dreams in European and international coaching senior competitions, and we all value their hard work.
Order of the day, three, first and second reading. One, a bill for an act to govern the organizational, administrative, and procedural matters associated with the holding of the referenda in Gibraltar. The Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to govern the organizational, administrative, and procedural matters associated with the holding of referenda in Gibraltar be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to govern the organizational, administrative, and procedural matters associated with the holding of referenda in Gibraltar be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Referendum Act 2015.
I have learned to move that the bill for Referendum Act 2015 now be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill provides a legal basis for the holding, or rather, I should say, for what we will be coming to later, a legislative basis for the holding of referendum in Gibraltar. Honourable members will know, Mr. Speaker, that the thinking behind this bill relates to the situation which manifested itself at the time of the atrocious joint sovereignty negotiations between the United Kingdom and Spain. At that time, Speaker, ill-informed and badly advised commentators in the UK and Spain started to suggest that a referendum in Gibraltar, which was not organised by the United Kingdom, would not have any legal validity. Mr. Speaker, that is, as this House will agree, utter nonsense. If that was common ground between both sides of the House at the time, and I trust, Mr. Speaker, it is still common ground across the floor of the House. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I want to refer the House in taking this bill to question 706 of 2002, where the subject was ventilated in the exchanges on that issue between the then Chief Minister, now the Honourable Backbencher Peter Caruana, and the then Leader of the Opposition, then and now as in the future, and for many years, we hope, the father of the House, Mr. Speaker. Let me highlight some parts of that exchange. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bafaro, in his supplementary session, said this: can I ask, in terms of the technical position to organise a referendum, the United Kingdom has said in Parliament, as is in the Westminster Parliament, that it is a matter for them both to decide the question, I think, and the timing that is put. On what basis do they think they have the right to say under the Constitution to do this without the support of the House? And the people then said this is to be I do not know, and they appear to think that this raises some legalistic issues, where, of course, the referendum is simply copying the ability of the community for people to express and free and democratic views. It does not raise any issue of law, and of course, there is nothing in the laws of the most of the entitled the UK, but not the Gibraltar government, to conduct a referendum. And there is nothing in the United Kingdom law in that respect either. I think the point they are making, which in my opinion is a complete non-sequitur, is that if the result of the referendum would require a change in English law, for example, if we all voted to be Spanish in this referendum, and this required some acts of Parliament to be passed, but they do not think that they should have to change the UK law except in response to a referendum that they have organised. I think that is a somewhat skewed thinking. The formal position follows. They say that they would like to organise in consultation with the government of the British, and I say that the Gibraltar government will organise it in consultation with the British government. In either event, the Gibraltar government reserves the right to organise a referendum in Gibraltar on any issue at any time of opportunity. There is nothing in the law preventing the Gibraltar government from doing so. Indeed, there is nothing in the law providing anybody in Gibraltar organising a referendum. I assume that is prohibiting anybody in Gibraltar organising a referendum. I note the amount of handset in that respect at page 635 of that particular handset. The idea to be that to be a valid expression of democratic will, it has got to somehow comply with some law which is non-existent in the event, but it has to comply with some law is a view for which I can see no rational consensus. In particular, the argument continues with both sides of the House being entirely of one mind in that respect. There are a few more exchanges where I don't need any to trouble the House with it. So, you see, as a result of that issue raising its head then, we committed ourselves in our manifesto for the general election to bring a bill for a referendum act. And we set out, Mr. Speaker, what that act would do. Under the heading referendum law, our manifesto says as follows. As became apparent at the time of the referendum in the 2006 Constitution, a later referendum, Mr. Speaker, which is also relevant, the legal base for consulting citizens through a referendum does not exist in Gibraltar as was confirmed at the time by the Attorney General. This does not mean that the referendum was illegal, as Spain had argued, but that the legal basis for it is not as strong as it could be. We will therefore introduce an Act of Parliament in our first year in office to cure this problem, to provide the legal basis for holding a referendum and the procedure to be followed. We will make provision for non-Gibraltarian British nationals residing in Gibraltar for over 10 years to be eligible to apply for Gibraltarian status and vote in such referendum. Something, Mr. Speaker, in such a that last phrase, which has already happened. Mr. Speaker, was the case that British citizens who have been resident for 10 years were given the opportunity to vote in the referendum from 2002. We were therefore only in effect given legal cover to what has been the case as an act of policy agreed between both sides of the House at the time that those particular referenda have been agreed. The speaker, that is therefore what the bill before the House today now seeks to do. Part one of the bill is concerned with the usual preliminary matters such as title, commencement, and interpretation, and part two contains the mechanism for calling of the referendum. A referendum is held, Mr. Speaker, when the Chief Minister makes an order pursuant to Clause 3. But an order under Clause 3 is only made either after the House has read a government bill for a second time, with the other stages then being adjourned for later date, or where this House has approved a government motion calling for a referendum. In the first instance, Mr. Speaker, if a bill is being put to the people in the referendum. Clause 4 of the bill sets out the contents of the order and what has to be contained in it, and this includes the day itself of when the question is going to be put, the question to be put, and also the percentage of votes that will be required to carry the vote. Clauses 5 and 6 are concerned with the appointment of the referendum administrator and related in those sort of issues. Part 3 of the bill then goes on in clauses 7 and 9 to relate to the qualification for participation. Clause 7 sets out the criteria for eligibility by reference to the voted metrics of the voter as is the case in elections. In very general terms, persons will become eligible if they meet the nationality criteria and have lived in Gibraltar during the qualifying period, which, as I've indicated, Mr. Speaker, should be 10 years. Clause 8 is not replicating the election situation and allows for a change to the minimum age, Mr. Speaker. If we eventually decide to change the minimum age for voting, then such a clause will not be relevant, but as the House will know, in a referendum in the United Kingdom recently, in the Scottish referendum, as it's known, the minimum age rating was reduced, although in this election in the United Kingdom, the age for voting remains 18. Part 4 of the bill contains the procedural requirements necessary to establish a list of reputation in Altamira, the provisions of election registration, again regarding polling stations, manning of the same, and these provisions allow for a secret ballot to be undertaken, of course. Unlike in the election registration, however, in the future, a polling station is referred to as a voting station. Part 6 of the bill relates to absentee voting, and Part 7 to postal voting. Again, these provisions allow for a replica of the existing election registration. Part 8 deals with the business end of the referendum and contains the procedural matters relating to the counting of voting papers, the verification, and the count itself, in addition to the declaration for the result. This is very important for the returning necessary to speak. Offences that may be committed in connection with the holding of a referendum are set out in Part 9 of the bill, and the penalty of the person has committed an offence is provided for in Clause 79. Part 10 of the bill, headed miscellaneous, contains Clause 83, and Clause 80 allows for the destruction of papers at least 12 months after a referendum has been held. Clause 81 says the validity of actions taken in the referendum process if observers are not present when they are undertaken, and Clause 82 gives the final say to the referendum administrator, as the returning officer is known in respect of referenda, in respect of organisational or ministerial procedural matters, or in any respect of any voting paper. Clause 83 is a wider regulation-making power that will allow for subsidiary legislation to be made. In Clause 83b, such a power extends to making regulations that may alter the application of the Act for the purpose of enabling the participation of voters who are unable to attend and vote in person. In a letter to the people that I have circulated to members, a new Part 11 is to be introduced at the committee stage with just one new clause. Clause 84, which will provide us that where a result has been declared in a referendum conducted in accordance with the Act, that result will be recognised and given effect to until the result of the subsequent referendum is required otherwise. Mr. Speaker, before I sit down to allow others to speak in the bill, I should add that the making of the Act for future referendum, which is what all the governments may organise after motion in this Parliament in respect of any particular bill, is not in any way calling to question the validity of any earlier referenda and does not give any credence or credibility to the ridiculous and undemocratic statement of those who so disgracefully wanted to silence the voice, their voice, and thwart the will and the expression of the wishes of the people of Gibraltar back in 2002. Mr. Speaker, I commend the vote of you.
Before I put question, does any other member wish to speak on the principles and merits of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, thank you. Mr. Speaker, sometimes let me say that I would very heartily support the bill to provide legislative underpinning for what we did back in 2002. And to the extent that this bill did that, I would have made a point to make sure that it was supporting it. As I have understood the bill, and it may be not what the honourable members intend, but as I have understood it, it does considerably more than that. And unless the honourable members can put my mind at rest, I will see how I can trustfully support the bill. Research derives is really one of the rare colours, and as I understood Clause 3, and indeed the honourable members of the Commission, this will create an act to allow the honourable members' offices to organise the referendum not on political grounds, which is what I would say to you about this, but rather to give the public at large an opportunity to express a view on any bill under consideration by the public after its second reading. Even governing Gibraltar by representative parliament in terms of legislation, all governed by referendum. But what it seems to me is that it is completely undermining the role of parliament as we have previously understood it, that as a bill is making its way through parliament, namely after the second reading of a government bill, so it may be that one of the members needs a bill to organise a specific referendum on a specific question. But that is not what it says, is it? It says any government bill. So you can have a bill about the price of fish, and after the second reading, the honourable member could call a referendum, and then presumably Parliament's will is obliged by the result of that referendum. I don't know if that is what was intended or not. It may not be. But I cannot imagine that it is consistent with the role of this Parliament or any Parliament, as we have hitherto understood it, that a referendum should be part of the legislative process of this parliament in this legislation. It seems to me that that is a much more radical transformation of the system of government in Bulgaria than a referendum to give status to underpinning to the political question. Obviously, there are political questions that have arisen in Bulgaria, which, as I've understood it, is what the honourable members intend to pursue by this day. And I'm just wondering whether they may, between now and the committee series, if the bill is not clear, I'm assuming that they agree with me, if they're not, whether it would be worth tightening up the language of the bill to make it clear what it is and clear what it is.
Any other honourable member wish to speak? Because
we would wish to hear what the honourable speaker has to say about the point that you, as a backbencher, has just made.
I understand that technically, Mr. Speaker, but of course, how the opposition is going to be voting depends on the answer that you think to provide to the honourable backbencher to this question. So,
Mr. Speaker, the fact is that I'm thinking of exactly what the honourable gentleman has indicated. This would be about political questions, not about legal questions. In taking advice, of course, we don't draft in short, from the draftsmen, they have come back with a model which is used in Canada in particular, which is not governed by referendum, it's governed by the Parliament, but does have the power to put bills to the general public in Canada in this form. In other words, at the end of the second reading, you can then move out and at least that's the advice that we have and go to a referendum on this issue. It is not our intention, nor do we envisage circumstances where we might do that. I suppose we all put our heads together, we could find such a situation. But the honourable gentleman is right. Our model of Parliament is that the government takes responsibility for the bills it brings to the Parliament and passes them with the governing majority. They don't enjoy a unanimity because that is government policy. Now, could there be circumstances where you want to take a bill from a second reading, suspend it to the referendum and bring it back to the Parliament? Well, if it were because there were divisions between both sides and the government were to lose that referendum, then it would say something about the confidence of the public in the government. That was never the intention that that we had. In fact, I put it to the honourable gentleman that should you wish to do that, then in fact you would have the power to do that without that clause, simply by having a government motion that appended to it a bill. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, what I'm going to propose, given that it's not our intention to try and seek controversy in respect to this particular bill, because I think what hearing and all that both sides identified should be cured to avoid the problems that we are dealing with, I'm going to propose, Mr. Speaker, at the committee stage, that we should delete clause 3A and be left only with clause 3B. And in other words, that clause 3 should just read as one clause without a small A or a small B. It should just read, the minister may make an order for a referendum to be held where Parliament has approved the government motion for a referendum. That still allows the government to speak that in the future, to the book, to put the bill to the public, once it's public, by simply attaching it to the motion. It's not what we envisage, and Speaker, I value that we might be able to count with the support of both sides of the House, but something that we consider to be a very important thing indeed for our political future, not an issue that we deal with having to deal with legislation in the Parliament, but that's possible. And I would, Mr. Speaker, therefore, prepare a written notice to the effect that I propose to do.
Mr. Speaker, on that basis, the opposition will be supporting the bill and will be voting in favour of it. No other member wishes to contribute, and I'll ask to move on to the reply. The Honourable Mr. Gozano.
Thank you,
Mr. Speaker, although we've never had any doubt about the validity of the referendum that we had in our history, and the first one in 1967 was organized by the United Kingdom government and still considered invalid by states, they doesn't matter to our neighbors who organizes the referendum. They only recognize the referendum that will never produce the result that they want. But if that produces tomorrow, they will say it is a legally valid one. And therefore, the only referendum that Spain will ever accept is a legitimate one, is a referendum which is devoted to Spain, which will never happen, and therefore will never, irrespective of what we do in this parliament, give recognition to the result. However, for us it is important, I think, to accept that predominantly on fundamental issues of the survival of our country, but also perhaps another thing where the House, on very rarely, but it has happened, has had a situation where members on both sides of the House were in agreement with each other and in disagreement with their colleagues. It happened on one of the occasions, maybe up in the last 42 years. And I think if it is an issue that is controversial and that is of such a nature that neither the opposition nor the government within their own ranks can get unanimity, because it is something that people take and hold very strong views of, independent of where they stand on the political spectrum, then I think it's legitimate to say, well, look, let's see whether the people agree with one view or the other. It is who are we, the 17 people in this room, to decide on something where there are very strong views made. I think it is important, if that happens, that the decisions that are then taken are then accepted as binding by those who were against it before, and accept that once you consult the people on something, it has to be respected. And therefore, the framework of making the referendum an instrument that is passed by the parliament, of course, tomorrow another parliament can decide to repeal the legislation and that will be the end of it. So it is not inhibiting a future parliament from having a different view. But I think that nobody would dream of doing anything in terms of talk about the vote of future that was in breach of the referendum that was conducted when we agreed in this House, organized by the government of Volta, in the context of the sharing of sovereignty that was being attempted by the government of the United Kingdom. The view was then very clear, it was overwhelming, and therefore nobody in his right mind wanted to touch the politics in Volta would want to go against that. But nevertheless, the fact is that there is nothing to stop the result being ignored. And what I think is important also in terms of creating a legal basis for the referendum is that the legal basis should be one that requires the result to be adhered to by a government, unless they go to the extent of saying I'm going to ignore that referendum. And if that happens, it should be going back to the people and against them if opinion has changed. Opinion on something might change. A different generation might have different views on anything. Nothing to do with the government on any other issue. Within the generation in Gibraltar, it perhaps have less of a gap than in other countries, but it can still happen. And therefore, I think it is something that is required, and it should be more than just creating the mechanics of how to do a referendum, but sending a very important message that ultimately there is a sovereignty higher than the sovereignty of Parliament, and there is the sovereignty of the people.
As I said, I'm grateful for the indication that given the amendment, the one of the members will be supporting this bill. I think it's important that this bill goes with unanimity, and I'm very proud to be able to present it and commend it to the bill.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to govern the organizational, administrative, and procedural matters associated with the holding of referenda in Gibraltar. We have the second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Referendum Act 2015.
I beg to notice that the committee statement first reading of the bill became today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement first reading of the bill became today?
Two. A bill for an act to amend the Electronic Commerce Act. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to amend the Electronic Commerce Act be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Electronic Commerce Act will be the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Electronic Commerce Amendment Act 2015.
The Speaker, I'd like to move that that bill now be read a second time. The Speaker, this bill, in effect, provides that the Electronic Commerce Act, which is already on our statute, should enjoy a small amendment as a precursor instruction of greater e-government by the introduction of a provision to regulate e-commerce where that commerce is not designed to be for profit. Now, the context of the word profit, the word commerce always might suggest profit. But when the government is going to come into this space to provide a public service, as a public body to the general public, and has no intention to making it for profit, to doing that for profit, we're advised that it would be in the interest of legal clarity to ensure that there is an amendment to show that the government itself will be covered by the provisions of this bill, which eventually relates to how that exchange of information occurs in the ether, in the virtual world. It's a short bill, Mr. Speaker. Honourable members will have seen it totally uncontroversial and not commendable.
Before I put the question, does anyone on the memo wish to speak on the general principles and merits of the bill? I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Electronic Commerce Act be heard a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Electronic Commerce Amendment Act 2015.
Speaker, I give notice that the committee statement, third reading of the bill, be taken today. Have all honourable members agreed?
Do all honourable members agree that the committee statement, third reading of the bill, be taken today?
Three. A bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar and for connected purposes. The Honourable the Minister for Education and Justice and International Exchange of Information.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar and for connected purposes to be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The University of Gibraltar Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that the bill be now read a second time. In November 2011, we published our election manifesto. In it, we said the following, I quote, "The University of Gibraltar will commence operations within 4 years. End quote. In a fast and ambitious manifesto, those 10 words represented a commitment of monumental proportions. It may not have been immediately obvious to those reading the manifesto, but that commitment would represent a massive advancement of what Gibraltar is, what Gibraltar represents, and how Gibraltar is to develop. As from September of this year, Gibraltar was set up to become a university city. It is a coming of age. It is a transformation in learning. It is a milestone in our history which comes only once, and which we, and I hope, many generations of Gibraltarians will cherish. We set to work straight away on making our commitment a reality. In 2012, we engaged Professor Daniel Hilbury to carry out a feasibility study on the university. That study concluded not only that it was feasible for Gibraltar to have its own university, but that the university could be very successful. In January 2014, Dr. Darren Shah was seconded from the Gibraltar Museum to the Department of Education to work exclusively on the university project. The work that Dr. Fadu, together with other members of the project team, was consolidated into a scheme which was launched as the University Project in October 2014. At that launch, we confirmed that the university would indeed open its doors in September 2015, and we announced the location of the university and the various faculties that would form part of it. Hours upon hours of thought, of discussion, of consultation, of identifying building needs, of
looking at the resources, both financial and human, that would be required, of considering the academic programs that could be offered, of visits to higher educational institutions in various places around the world, of working through a number of statuses, operational and governance models, have brought us to where we are today, on the verge of a landmark event. This bill will establish the University of Gibraltar and set a framework for the university to function. This is, of course, only one element of what needs to come together to allow the university to open its doors in September. We have already brought to this House a bill to appropriate £10 million for the university. The bill was passed in October 2014. That funding enables building work to commence. Now, I'm glad to report that work continues at full pace at the site of the former St. Christopher School to convert two emblematic buildings into our university. Europa Point is a magnificent location for the university and allows the creation of a campus with room for expansion in the future, an expansion which will see new facilities added, including student accommodation. The existing buildings are being brought back to life in a way which not only preserves, but enhances the heritage value of those buildings. An 18th century stone building with high vaults will house the library, a computer suite for study and for online exams, a hall where conferences can be hosted, and the administration center of the university. There will be an outside courtyard surrounded by rooms for teaching staff and research students. A building known as the Defensible Barracks has 10 vaults, which will be primarily used for teaching. Between the two main buildings, a glass roof structure will be installed to create a large open atrium, which I expect will be a hive of activity for students. On either side of the atrium are two new constructions, with a student cafeteria and a training kitchen for the Faculty of Hospitality on one side, and a research laboratory for the Faculty of Life and Health Sciences, and a simulation suite for the Faculty of Health Studies on the other. On top of the Defensible Barracks, the southernmost building, will be a restaurant which will form part of the Faculty of Hospitality, and which will be open to the public. The restaurant will enjoy unrivaled and unobstructed views of the Strait and Africa. This will in fact be one of the most attractive places in the whole of Europe in which to enjoy a meal. I've already announced, Mr. Speaker, the university will have four faculties, an institute for professional development and continuing education, and a language center. The faculties are the Faculty of Health Studies and Sports Studies, the Faculty of Business, the Faculty of Tourism and Hospitality, and the Faculty of Life and Earth Sciences, in Gibraltar and in Mediterranean Studies. On health studies, there will be a continuation of the program offered by the Gibraltar Health Authority, namely a Bachelor of Science degree in nursing and a Master's in Leadership and Management in healthcare. These programs are accredited and directed by Kingston University. On business, there will be a series of programs taught which are part of the University of London International Programs. I'm glad to announce today what those programs will be. There will be a Bachelor of Science degree in Accounting and Finance, a Bachelor of Science degree in Banking and Finance, and a Bachelor of Science degree in Business and Management. In addition, there will be offered a Diploma for Graduates in Banking and a Diploma for Graduates in Accounting. All of these programs are directed by the London School of Economics through the University of London International Programme. Initially, these will be offered on a part-time basis through evening classes, so they will be accessible to everyone in the region. We expect full-time programs to also be offered as from 2016. The Faculty of Business will progress to also offer computing courses as from 2016. In addition, the Faculty of Business will offer courses in Gibraltar Law and in Gibraltar Tax. These will be taught over 24 weeks with a 2-hour lecture each week. Mr. Speaker, the University of Gibraltar has consolidated the association and collaboration with Oxford Brook University. Through that association, the Faculty of Tourism and Hospitality will offer throughout the next year a series of practical programs in hospitality and hospitality culture. We expect the faculty to progress to academic programs
Act 1,016. The Faculty of Life and Earth Sciences, with Gibraltar Mediterranean Studies, will incorporate two research institutes. The Institute of Life and Earth Sciences will deal with scientific research. The Institute of Gibraltar and Mediterranean Studies will concentrate on research into social science fields. The Gibraltar Museum, the Garrison Library, and the Gibraltar Botanical Garden will form part of the research institute and will be part of the extended campus of the university. The faculty will offer research courses leading to PhDs. We expect that up to 10 PhD opportunities will be offered during the course of the first year. These will cover a wide cross-section of topics. They will include topics in areas such as macaque behavior management, the marine biology of the Gibraltar waters and the seas, the modern constitutional development of the Gibraltar, Neanderthal life in and around the Gibraltar, corporate cloud policing and behavior, and responsible gambling. This will be the start in the evolution of the research facility, which we hope will expand and make the Gibraltar a major center for academic and scientific research. The Institute of Professional Development and Continuing Education will offer professional development for both the public and private sectors. There will be four courses developed to meet industry needs, as well as courses leading to professional qualifications, such as accounting professions, the Institute of Legal Secretaries, and the Chartered Management Institute. These will be expanded over time into other areas where a need is identified in consultation with relevant industry associations. Speaker, the Language Centre will concentrate on the teaching of English as a professional or business language. In order to be able to attract students from abroad to take these courses, it will be necessary for us to be able to offer appropriate student accommodation. I therefore expect these courses to start during 2015. I would add, Mr. Speaker, that the potential for the Language Centre is truly enormous. Every year, tens of thousands of students attend language centers in UK and elsewhere to learn not just English, but English for professionals, with specific courses offered for different industries. There are, for example, courses in English for engineers, or English for aviation, and many more. Gibraltar is particularly well placed to attract many students from all over the world, with English as our main language, and a location which is in many ways unique and attractive. We are well poised to make this area an economic driver for our community. This is not just true for the university, though. This is an area where private providers could step up and the teaching of English could become a huge industry for Gibraltar. The University of Gibraltar's Language Centre is therefore set to play a pioneering role and to act as a launchpad and capital for the development of a new industry. That, Mr. Speaker, is the impact that we expect our university to have. The Speaker, I turn to the bill itself. There are some amendments proposed to the bill as originally published. These are set out in a letter from the Speaker dated 23rd March, which includes a schedule of the proposed changes and exact version of the bill showing the changes. I will formally move. My list of 23rd maybe may have been the 24th when it was actually sent to the Speaker. It wasn't at the 24th. Yes, I have a copy of the letter in front of me, which is the 24th. I'm grateful to the Honourable Member for pointing that out. I will formally move the amendments to the bill at committee. I will be speaking to the bill as proposed to the amendment, and I will, of course, be happy to address them in my reply any questions that the opposition may have on the proposed amendments. I think that this is a bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar. The university is founded and constituted as a statutory body. The bill provides for the university to be a body corporate with the ability to sue and be sued in its own name and to have its own freedom. Part 3 of the bill contains important statements of principle. There are provisions for institutional autonomy so that the university is board and its constituent body are free from interference from all external bodies, authorities, or agencies. This part also provides for academic freedom, where the requirement of the principles of inquiry and research, teaching, and intramural and extramural expression shall be respected. The university will have a power in its own right and name to grant degrees, including research and honorary degrees, diplomas, and certificates. The functions of a university and the duties of a university are set out in Clause 8. The functions of a university include establishing and maintaining faculties, institutes, departments, schools, colleges, and academic fairs, and to provide courses of instruction in the various branches of knowledge, and to establish facilities for the pursuit of original research. The university will be headed by a chancellor, who will be the university's titular head, and will have no executive role. The chancellor is appointed by the minister with responsibility for education. The university will have a vice chancellor, who is appointed by the board with the consent of the minister. The bill provides for the vice chancellor to be the chief executive officer, who sets the strategic direction of the university and provides it with academic leadership. There will be a board of directors. The board is responsible for the management, administration, and control of the property, revenue, and business of the university, but not for academic governance. The board is composed of up to 7 persons, made up of the vice chancellor, the director of education, the university's financial controller, and up to 4 persons appointed by the minister. The minister may increase the number of members of the board at his request, and any such additional members are appointed by the board. The chairman of the board is appointed by the minister from among its members. As I have indicated, Mr. Speaker, the board is responsible for all the business of the university, but not for academic governance. It is customary for academic governance to be vested in a separate body. The bill contains provisions for the establishment by the minister of an academic board, council, senate, or equivalent body to undertake the academic governance functions of the university. Pending the establishment of such a body, the university's academic governance functions are undertaken by the vice chancellor. There are provisions in the bill for the recognition of a student union and for the student union and any student society to operate in a fair and democratic manner and to be accountable for its finances. Part 7 of the bill deals with interim governing arrangements, with the power given to the minister to designate an initial governing authority and to determine its powers and duties. The initial governing authority shall have the powers of the vice chancellor until the appointment of the vice chancellor, of the first vice chancellor, and of the board until the commencement of the board's first meeting. These provisions are essential so that the university can start to function whilst it is taking shape and it is up and running, with all its constituent parts, officers, and members appointed for taking place. Honourable members will be aware that the government has incorporated the University of Gibraltar Limited as the vehicle through which the university is being delivered, and has engaged staff and entered into contracts, such as the contract for the construction work at the Europa Bond site. The company is the operating vehicle for the university project. Mr. Speaker, it is my intention to designate the University of Gibraltar Limited as the initial governing authority, so that the university itself can start to function. Once all the necessary appointments and structures are made or put in place, it is the government's intention to transfer the shares of in the University of Gibraltar Limited to the university established by this bill. In that way, there will be a seamless transition from the government project that the university currently is to a fully functioning and structured university as an independent statutory body. It will, of course, be up to the university board to determine whether it keeps the University of Gibraltar Limited as its operating vehicle. It probably makes sense for the board to do so, but that would be a decision for the board and not for the government. Part 8 of the bill contains financing provisions with an obligation created on the university to use its best endeavors to become self-financing. Subject to certain safeguards, the university will have powers to borrow and to invest. Part 9 deals with the acquisition of property and provides for the property and income of the university to be exempt from taxation. Quality assurance and regulatory provisions are contained in Part 10. A power is given to the minister to establish or designate a quality assurance authority to be known as the Gibraltar Authority for Standards in Higher Education. The purpose of the Gibraltar Authority for Standards in Higher Education is to establish and safeguard academic standards and to provide quality assurance in respect of the university's academic program. It should be noted, Mr. Speaker, that the primary responsibility for quality assurance
of its academic program vests with the university itself and not with an external body. It will be for the university, through its academic board, council, senate, or equivalent body, establishment of the power given in Clause 29, or pending the establishment of such a body through the vice chancellor, to create the necessary structures for quality assurance and for the maintenance of standards in the academic program. There is, nevertheless, a role to be played also by an external body in ensuring that both standards and quality assurance are maintained. In the UK, that is a function of the quality assurance agency. At the outset, it may not be necessary for an external quality assurance authority to be established or designated. That is because the degree programs that are being offered in conjunction with Kingston University or as part of the University of London International Programme already come with a necessary quality assurance. In due course, it will be necessary for the both authorities to standard in higher education to be established, or for another body, such as the UK Quality Assurance Agency, to be asked to carry out its functions. Discussions to this effect have already taken place with the Quality Assurance Agency, and a power exists in the bill to delegate this function to such a body. There is a separate provision in the bill for a regulatory authority to be known as the Director of Higher Education Commission. To be established, it can be established or designated. The functions of the Commission will be to regulate the affairs of the university by making sure that statutory provisions are complied with and statutory powers are not exceeded. It is necessary to distinguish between an external body that looks at academic standards, that would be the role of the Director of Authority for Standards in higher education, and an external body that ensures compliance with statutory provisions other than academic governance. That is the role of the Gibraltar Higher Education Commission. The Gibraltar Regulatory Authority has agreed to carry out the function for the Gibraltar Higher Education Commission, and arrangements by the GRA to be able to provide this have already been made. It will therefore be my intention to designate the GRA to carry out the function for the Gibraltar Higher Education Commission. This will be one more strand of the work of the GRA, which already deals with the regulation of telecommunications, satellite, postal services, and data protection. Mr. Speaker, Part 12 contains miscellaneous provisions, including provisions to prevent any person other than the university, without the consent of the board, to hold himself or itself out of the university or use the title or style of the University of Gibraltar. It also provides protection against the misuse of the university's coat of arms, logo, insignia, or emblem. A contravention of these provisions amounts to an offence, with a penalty and summary conviction being imprisonment for 6 months or a fine not exceeding twice level five on the standard scale for both. There is an exclusion of liability to the university for acts of students and protection for acts or omissions by officers of the university in good faith in the execution of duties carried out on behalf of the university, unless those acts or omissions arise from great negligence. Finally, there is a power given to the Minister to make rules, regulations, and orders to fulfill the purposes and objectives of the Act. The Bill, Mr. Speaker, sets out a comprehensive framework for the establishment and functioning of the university. It provides for the university's independence, for its governance structure, for academic governance, for interim governing arrangements, for the university's financing and investments, for accountability and reporting, and for quality assurance and regulation. In September, the University of Gibraltar will open its doors to the whole community. The statutory framework, the building, the staff, the initial academic and professional development program should all be in place by then. Mr. Speaker, the university has been described many times as an exciting project. It is much more than pure excitement that we feel. Exciting doesn't even begin to express fully what it is that we are building and what it is that the university can become and achieve for Gibraltar. With the enactment of this legislation, an institution that will change and benefit Gibraltar in many ways is born. It elevates Gibraltar to the rank of those cities that are able to welcome international students to carry out important research, to engage in academic programs, or even to learn English tailored for the profession in which they are engaged. It will provide opportunities for Gibraltarians who have either already returned from studying abroad and want additional qualifications,
or who want to do a third degree locally. There will be opportunity to serve if the areas which will make a real difference to our community. There will be constant interaction with industry, with professional courses to lead to those of you. There will be specific and high quality training for the hospitality industry. There will be job opportunities in higher education which have never been possible in the water. The university will be an economic driver, not just for itself, but for the entire community. In a nutshell, Mr. Speaker, the university is an institution for the whole of the water, and I look forward to welcoming everyone to the university when it opens for public viewing in September. Mr. Speaker, it is with enormous pleasure and with a huge sense of responsibility and pride that I commend the state of the world.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As we have officially said at the time of the supplementary appropriation bill, this side of the House is supportive of the concept of establishing the University of Gibraltar. It is indeed something that, as the Chief Minister said himself at the time, has been a project long trailed by more than one political party in the history of this House and its previous office. But, Mr. Speaker, in doing so, I would like to ask the Honourable Minister for Education for a little bit of clarification in some part. Seeing that this side of the House is very much committed to the successful development and continuing education, and so on, which is embedded in the principles of what in the rest of you being established for, in coordination, Mr. Speaker, there is a section that says that the councils of the university are followed, and it mentions, in the general sense of, in the general meaning of the word, schools and colleges. And I, at least just across the floor, if I get an assurance that it is not the intention of the university to take over primary or secondary education in the world, but rather, you know, for a higher education interpretation. That is why schools and colleges have been included in that section there. I look forward later on in the political stage, Mr. Speaker, to hearing from the Minister the amendments that he is introducing in regard to the composition of the board, because we want to have a board that is independent of our own political interference and so on. But it seems to me that the board is going to be composed of the two employees of the university, that is, the Vice Chancellor and the Vice-Chancellor Chair, the Director of Education as an ex-official member, and then the Minister will appoint, you know, four other persons and so on. I look forward to hearing what the Minister has to say in respect of maintaining a certain, you know, independence and freedom that board needs in order to carry out its duties properly. More so, even to speak to Section 46, because an annual report has to be presented by the Vice Chancellor and the Board. It has to be presented to the Minister. With that, the Board has to arrange for the audit of annual accounts and so on. And given that this House has already approved the expenditure of $10 million, we took our expenses for the next 2 or 3 years, but one can foresee, because we're supportive in investing in education and so on, that there will be contributions from this House going towards the university. There is nowhere, normally, there's nowhere in this bill that clarifies, you know, whether that report should later on, once the Minister has had time to see it, and perhaps I'll have to make the relevant questions on the board, where that report and its financial outcomes will be reported, whether it will be laid for the record in this Parliament, or whether it will be published, because it will be the university's intention under the board to publish that. So the public of the board is aware of where their money, which we are supportive of the group at the time of the supplementary appropriation, is where the money is being spent, so we can really drive our value for money. With that, Mr. Speaker, I will look forward to the next speaker.
Does any other honourable member wish to speak? The honourable Mr. Speaker,
Mr. Speaker, I'm not sure that I would Clause 29,
9, then they want to say the Minister needs to take Section 15, establish and provide an academic board and some of the equivalent bodies to undertake the academic governance function of the university, otherwise undertaken by the board. I just wonder whether this is a calibrated attempt, a calibrated foreign consideration and division attempt of ministerial power, whatever the word is, power over the affairs of a board to put a power of appointment. And have the honourable members given any consideration to some other model which somehow makes the university not just be stated to be independent, as in the prior decision, but through the degree of control, and I don't say that the minister should have no control, hence I spoke about the department. This is an important academic function, it's important to maintain standards, there are questions of the image of the growth abroad, there is a question of the government funding, there is a question of the extent to which the government may want to use the university as a tool of policy, to deliver, for example, as you just announced, the bar council, the solicitors and barristers, the qualifications thing. They might be leader of an instrument of economic policy for trade and trade. So there are any number of reasons that rejected the government rightly reserved the ability to ensure that the publicly funded organization doesn't be spread the needs and interests of the community as primarily identified by the government that has overarching responsibility for that in our democracy. But it seems to me that the bill itself functions contrast a statement of independence with actually the usual gate of ministerial control which successive governments have given successive ministers in successive areas of activity in the world.
Any other honourable member who wishes to contribute?
Speaker, as the Prime Minister for Education and quite rightly said, the opposition is going to be supportive of this bill and really supportive the bill that was brought to supplementary funding. I'd ask you to clarify one point, and why do I think Section 54 is enhancing? And that is that as to the scope of Section 54, which is an immunity from suit, from proceedings. And it says no actions or proceedings should be brought against a member of the board of faculty, an officer or employee of the university, or against the initial governing authority. And then at subsection 3 it says no action shall lie against the university that appears that the university acted under the authority of this act or any other act. Now the university itself, as I understand it, but I'll be correct if I'm wrong, has no separate legal standing. It's going to be the limited company that effectively is going to be running the university. Now, I may be wrong about that, but I'm thinking about, for example, cases in the Industrial Tribunal. I mean, it doesn't envisage that this clause is going to cap any claim for unfair dismissal, for example, or any other type of claim that may be properly brought against that limited company, or indeed against the university if the university has some separate personality by virtue of this act or otherwise. And I just ask the honourable gentleman to perhaps clarify that for me.
Honourable Dr. Cortez.
Mr. Speaker, as someone who has spent most of his life moving in and around the world of academia, I feel I must say a few words in support of the bill, and by way of congratulating my colleague, the Minister for Education, and the team that have been working to bring this bill to us today. Mr. Speaker, I don't think we can overstate the significance of what we're doing here today, the tremendous potential that the university has, and the fact that it will open more doors than we even know are there to be opened. Mr. Speaker, I still have considerable contact in the academic world, and I have received many words of congratulation and many words of interest in what we are doing in Gibraltar. It has certainly created great interest in the academic world. And wherever I have gone, and in areas where I have been in academic circles, I have been congratulated for the vision that the devoted government has had in creating a university. Mr. Speaker, the University of Gibraltar, I feel, will be one of the most important and significant achievements of this government, and possibly will be the most significant part of its undoubted and unequaled legacy.
Mr. Speaker, as most Gibraltarian students will know, especially those of the Academy of Science at the University, the University is a place of not just of organisms, but also of organisms, as the Honourable Gentleman has referred us to, which is everything that education is about. Mr. Speaker, Tony Blair, I wish further education. Mr. Speaker, Tony Blair has said many things with which people can disagree, and rightly so, in particular in Gibraltar. If there is one thing that Tony Blair said once, that people in Gibraltar will be able to agree with, when asked what a priority for a Labour government should be, and he answered education, 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 then that is certainly something that we can all agree with. Mr. Speaker, I rise because I want to commend the work that has been done by the team in the Department of Education, led by the Minister for Education and Director of Education, in particular by Mr. Darren Farr, who's very closely associated with the project, and they've done a lot of what we might call the legwork, and now the appointment of Ms. Daniela Silvey. But, Mr. Speaker, when I rise and guess to talk about education, 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 I want to talk also about milestones. And milestones in our modern history of education have been set by the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party when in government, in this respect, Mr. Speaker. The front page of this week's Economist, Mr. Speaker, carries a very apposite front page, almost as if they knew that the Minister was going to move this bill. It is, Mr. Speaker, the whole world is going to university, and it contains a special report that deals with university education. There are two parts of this report in particular I want to refer the House to when considering education and how it has developed and how we are now led to this university. In the lead article, Mr. Speaker, the Economist says this: if people need a degree to get ahead, then democratic governments must offer everybody with sufficient brains a chance of getting one. And that is exactly what in 1988 the then BSOP government ensured could happen by the introduction of the mandatory scholarship scheme. Speaker, elsewhere in the same leading article, the following: as first degrees become standard, more people are getting their credit education to stand out from the crowd. In both America and Britain, 14% of the adult workforce have a postgraduate degree, and despite the increase in supply, the postgraduate premium has increased in both America and Britain, especially since 2000. And Mr. Speaker, in 2011, our manifesto for the general election provided that we would move the Department of Education from simply providing first degrees as a mandatory requirement, as we had introduced in 1988, to providing, because of this competition of people who already had a first degree, that all those who wish to and were able to obtain the first university would be able to access a second degree, a higher degree. Mr. Speaker, that demonstrates our commitment to education, education, and now with the university, education. Mr. Speaker, the conclusion of the lead article in The Economist says this: but access to higher education is not binary. Some provision is excellent and some is not, and the returns to low quality higher education are poor. So the ambition expressed by pretty much all governments everywhere to widen access to good quality higher education conflicts with another global force: competition to create the best universities.
I think that it's important for the Parliament to realise that the road in which the government is embarked under the stewardship of the Honourable the Minister for Education is not a rush to the average. It's not a move in haste to just create another institution. But as he has demonstrated in the past 3 years since he started work on the subject, he has moved the Parliament on a number of occasions to consider and deal and support the legislation and motions that are brought in relation to the university. We are embarked under the Minister for Education and this government in a careful endeavour, Mr. Speaker, towards creating a great university, a great institution. And in so doing, Mr. Speaker, we're not just going to create a place of learning, but as he said himself, Mr. Speaker, I hope that we are also sowing the seed for new and future economic activity for our nation.
The Honourable Minister of Education.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. I'm certainly very satisfied to see that this bill will enjoy the support of the whole House. This is an institution, as I have said, for the voter generally, and we do expect many good things to come out of the institution. Taking the points that have been raised by honourable members, rather instead earlier mentioned the possibility in the bill of the university establishing schools and colleges and wondering whether we're going to create a primary school in the university site. Certainly not, Mr. Speaker. It is customary these days for many universities to operate within the university itself, if their own schools and colleges. And for example, Oxford Brookes University operates the School of Hospitality Management. That's part of the higher education offering of Brookes University. As we know, universities such as Cambridge and Oxford operate through colleges of their own. So any reference in the field to any department, faculty, institutions clearly are all within the framework of what it is we are establishing. This is a higher education institution, and that's where the university needs to remain as a higher education institution. Honourable Member mentioned the appointment of persons to the board, which is also the point raised by the Speaker, that one about, on the one hand, there being established in the bill itself the basic principles of institutional autonomy and academic freedom to provide for the independence of the university, and it is pretty strong language that the bill provides. There shall be no external interference by some agencies or authorities, and that clearly includes the government. So in the functioning of the university, there shall not be interference, and it will function as an independent organ, as a statutory body, with its constituent back part, in particular the Board of Governors. Somebody has to appoint the members of the board. And the other member asked whether there could have been other possibilities. Well, perhaps there could have been. But we've looked at statutory frameworks in Gibraltar, and the honourable member has himself referred to various agencies and authorities that have been established. But there are some, for example, the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority. That one, in particular, operates as a statutory body, totally independent, has regulatory sanctions, which are independent of government, and yet its members are appointed by the minister, the chief minister. And that's an act that goes from 2000, I think it was all, and therefore an act that the honourable member passed, who was the chief minister of the government at the time. The fact that appointments are made, the fact that the minister has the power to make the regulations and to whom reports are submitted, should not, and in the government's view, in this particular case, will not undermine at all the independence of the university. It is intended that the university should operate as an independent body, take its own decisions, and certainly there has to be some accountability. Well, again, the speaker is because there has to be a power to remove. There might be an argument if the other member wants to make a point that there could be an amendment for cause, but then what is cause in the context of a member of the board? And clearly, no minister would be normal simply because the minister wants or doesn't like a particular person. But let me just say this before I give way. The power to remove a member of the board only applies to members appointed by the minister. There is a possibility of members being appointed by the board itself, and the board provides for them. There is no provision for those members to be removed by the minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member is right. There are bills, other bills relating to authority and things that give the minister power to remove people from board. But they're all for cause, and the cause is UDR, commission of a criminal offence, bankruptcy, failure of the attend meeting. I can't think of any, in fact, I would venture to suggest that there aren't any, in which a minister, in the name of a power relating to a so-called independent body, has the power to remove will and without cause, it's going to a 1.5-line panel that simply says you can have any time you move whoever you want from the board. I don't think that there is any. I'm not saying that the Honourable Member is minded to do this or any of his successors in office is going to be minded to do this. I suppose it would be accountable to Parliament and to public opinion that they did. But in terms of the integrity of the act itself and of the. The rest of the bill looking as independent as clauses 5 and 6 rightly profess that it wants to be, it's just a rather odd summary comment that a politician should have the right, without cause or without explanation, to remove somebody from a board that the Act says is got to be independent and can't be interfered with by any authority, including the minister. Well, it's very easy to see how someone feels that he's removable at will by somebody, doesn't feel entirely independent from what he knows that person's wishes are in the exercise of a so-called independent power. And you might say a weakness of the appointee or lack of gumption, and that may well be right. But in terms of appearance, you wouldn't expect to find a provision of this sort in respect of in the UK, for example, and I don't hold the UK out as an example of this necessarily follow the first year. They are on some things and aren't on others. But I do think that in the UK, an institution whose governing body could be removed at will by a minister would be regarded as independent of the government. I clause 5 wants it to say. Now, it's not I wouldn't give this point to detract from my enthusiasm for the project as a whole, but if the Honourable Member wanted to just say the expert mile and signal independence, it would be relatively easy to borrow one of these removal clauses from the other bill and put it on. But it won't affect my support for the bill as a
Speaker, let me assure the Honourable Member that there is no clear motion. There has, in fact, been no specific consideration that the word for cause should be removed and that there should be a summary power at will. I am looking now at the provisions of the Tobacco Regulatory Authority Act, which sets out a list of matters which the Minister can be satisfied on, being absent and bankrupt. Being incapacitated or otherwise unable or unfitted to discharge the functions of a member, and then the minister may, in consultation with members of the devoted regulatory authority, declare that person's office as a member to be vacant. We have no particular issue with a similar provision being moved at committee stage because, as I said, there wasn't any particular intention that the bill should have that summary power in that particular way. It wasn't intended to be. I am grateful to the Honourable Member
it's really only wonderful question that I can use the back to make an amendment. The Honourable Mr. Reyes also mentioned the annual report and how it is a report to be published. This is a statutory body, it's a public institution. I would expect, although no provision is made for it in the bill, but an administrative matter, I would simply expect that the report would be published in the university's website on a yearly basis. That is probably the expectation. And the point made by the leader of the opposition, related to clause 54(3) about the university, whether it has a legal, separate legal standing, the answer is yes, it does. That's provided in clause 54, which is headed body corporate, and it says the university is a body corporate, may sue and be sued in its own name, and shall have its own field, and therefore the university itself can be sued. What clause 54 does provide some protection against the university, where the university is simply fulfilling its function, but I can certainly foresee that if at any time a person who is an employee of the university who is unfairly dismissed, that person should certainly have the right to go to the investor tribunal and sue the university itself as the employer. That is certainly possible. If the university continues to operate under the university of the local limited, and the employer is in fact the limited company, then there is a possibility of having to speed up against the limited company, for example, in the unfair dismissal procedure. So that one of the members should have no worries in that regard. And finally, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful for the comments on this side of the House. Certainly, education has been something at the heart of the DSOC since it came to effect in 1988. It pioneered the expansion of higher education with the introduction of mandatory scholarships for anyone who had a place to study at a recognized institution. When we came into government in 2011, we extended that to give mandatory rights for people to continue in higher education. We want to continue to foster that possibility. We recently made available figures in this particular house about 866 students being currently funded. That is an extraordinary amount of students in higher education being funded by the government in a community, the small community that we are. This is a record that we can be proud of, and this is another leg in higher education. It is a new school in higher education, something which, as I said, will benefit the whole world of the water. When we see what it is that we are doing, or we will over to visit that, I expect that there will be a couple of open days before formal opening, so that the whole of the community can come along and see what it is that we create, and we have a drink and we toast with us the opening of the new university in September. I think everybody interested will be very, very proud of what it is that we have achieved. Perhaps to give way to the Honourable Member.
I just say this, whether the Honourable Member intended to be assessed or not, it's a possibility. In Section 54, the immunity point, I notice that this is drafted. There are other states of regulatory legislation, for example, the Financial Services Commission Act, has a statute of exemption for membership. But it's drawn slightly narrower to make it clear, I can't remember the exact wording, but I'm almost certain the language is drawn in terms that the exception, the immunity can be extended only to regulatory licenses. The way this is drafted, for example, except in the case of gross negligence, you wouldn't be able to bring a suit under the occupied liability for special injuries or anything like that with complete and blanket immunity for anything. I can't imagine they're actually intention, but what is in the language that the Honourable Member thinks is not prevents you from having that effect? It might seem to be.
The language is contained in the clause itself. The last bit of the clause, which talks about the immunity from suit and the last in the text of the book, and then at the end it says, for an act
the effect of a natural emission by anyone, which is done or omitted to be done in good faith in the course of execution of a person's duties on behalf of the university. So it is limited to anything that the person does in the course of his duties on behalf of the university, and it needs to be done in good faith. Then there is an exception by the next sub-clause, which says it does not apply in the case of gross negligence. So even in the person's execution of his duties on behalf of the university, where the person is guilty of gross negligence or liable in respect of an act of gross negligence, then there is no need. But it clearly only applies in the restricted way of the person having to act on behalf of the university in carrying out, or looking to act on behalf of the university in carrying out the function and the duties.
But it wouldn't extend to civil action which has nothing to do with academic acts or anything, but rather it could be related to damage to property and injury to person. There are sort of things that the operators of the building could mention to people. If he is satisfied, he knows that time by the way, this is not the right plan.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I am satisfied. This is limited to acts or missing done in the execution of the duty. What is in the execution of the duty is an element that would be for the court. Whereas when somebody acts in a particular way, for example, if someone disregards a particular act in respect of health and safety, is that person acting in the execution of the duty in omitting to act in pursuance of a statutory duty? That would be a matter for the court to determine, as a matter of fact, but I'm satisfied with the language that is presented. Because this is an occasion for all of us to be grateful about, and I'm grateful that this landmark piece of legislation enjoys the support of the whole House of the Senate.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar and for connected purposes be read a second time. Those in favour, those against, can't. The University of Gibraltar Act 2015.
This is our best to give notice of the committee statement, third reading of the show, be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee statement, third reading of the bill be taken today. Four. A bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission. Encourage businesses to comply with consumer law and improve their trading practices. Streamline and simplify the trade licensing system. Establish enforcement powers for the trade licensing authorities being part of the Office of Fair Trading in cases of non-adherence by licensees. Establish a single point of contact as part of the trade licensing procedures. Amend the law relating to the protection of the collective interest of consumers. Enable action to be taken against conduct detrimental to consumers. And for purposes committed therewith, the Honourable the Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, conscious of our discussions for weeks before last, in respect to the amendments that are proposed to me on the Fair Trading Bill, and in the light of your advice, I wish to give notice that the bill will not proceed today. For the purposes of Hansard and the way of explanation, I wish to state that the bill is, for all intents and purposes, ready to proceed. And only requires, for the most part, domestic amendments that are of no substance, but that reflect and change the name of the relevant statutory body with the resulting consequential amendments throughout the bill. In particular, I refer the House to the change of name from Trade Licensing Authority to the Business Licensing Authority and the substitution of the phrase trade to carry on business. Given that the amendments are numerous as a result of the references in the bill, for the Trade Licensing Authority and to trade, and in accordance with your advice that it is needed to simply proceed to republish the bill incorporating the amendment, I will accede to your guidance and a new bill will be published afresh for consideration at a future meeting of the House. To conclude, I wish to add that I have already notified and discussed that this with the opposition spokesman for commercial affairs, the Honourable Mr. Seymour. I call before the House, Mr. Speaker. I also wish to thank the Honourable Gentleman for his engagement in my office and I, and this bill, and I am sure he will be delighted to learn that of all of these amendments, all but one have been accepted.
I'm very grateful to the Honourable Minister.
Five. A bill for an act to transpose into the Law of Gibraltar provisions of Directive 2009/138/EC of the European Parliament and of the Council in the taking up and pursuit of the business of insurance and the insurance, Solvency II, and the provisions of Directive 2014/51/EU of the European Parliament and of the Council amending Directive 2003/71/EC and 2009/138/EC and Regulations EC number 1060/2009, EU number 1094/2010, and EU number 1095/2010, in respect of the powers of the European Supervisory Authority, European Insurance and Occupational Pension Authority, and the European Supervisory Authority, European Securities and Markets Authority, and related matters. The Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Government.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to read the bill for an act to transpose into the Law of Gibraltar provisions of Directive 2009/138/EC of the European Parliament and of the Council on the taking up and pursuit of the business of insurance and reinsurance in 2022, and provisions of Directive 2014/51/EU of the European Parliament and of the Council amending Directive 2003/71/EC and Regulations EC number 1060/2009. EU number 1094/2010 and EU number 1095/2010, in respect of the powers of the European Supervisory Authority, the European Insurance and Occupational Pension Authority, and the European Supervisory Authority, the European Securities and Markets Authority, and related matters, be ratified too. I now put a question, which is a veritable time twister, namely, that a bill for an act to transpose into the Law of Gibraltar provisions of Directive 2009/138/EC of the European Parliament and of the Council on the taking up and pursuit of the business of insurance and reinsurance, Solvency II, and provisions of Directive 2014/51/EU of the European Parliament and of the Council amending Directive 2003/71/EC and 2009/138/EC and Regulations EC number 1060/2009 and EU number 1094/2010 and EU number 1095/2010 in respect of the powers of the European Supervisory Authority, brackets, European Insurance and Occupational Pension Authority, close the brackets, and the European Supervisory Authority, brackets, European Securities and Markets Authority, close the brackets, and related matters be read at first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Financial Services Insurance Companies Solvency II Directive Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move it today, and I'll be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the bill is designed to transpose into the Law of Gibraltar the European Union Directive of 2009 known as Solvency II, as has been amended extensively by the 2014 Directive known as Omnibus II. The Directive deals broadly with codifying and harmonising the regulation of the insurance industry within the European Union in general. Most importantly, it deals with the amount of capital that EU insurance companies must hold to reduce the risk of insolvency. In the words of the European Commission, the Solvency II regime introduces for the first time a harmonised, sound and robust prudential framework for insurance firms in the European Union. It is based on the risk profile of each individual insurance company in order to promote comparability, transparency and competitiveness. The bill and the directive introduce economic risk-based solvency requirements for insurance undertakings. The new solvency requirements are designed and intended to be more risk-sensitive and more sophisticated than in the past, reflecting the real and actual risks run by each insurer in place of the present more generic approach. Solvency requirements will therefore be more comprehensive than in the past, and insurers will now be required to hold capital against market risk,
credit risk and operational risk. The new rules also require insurers to disclose more information to the public and are designed to promote greater cooperation between national insurance supervisors that they receive a subsidiary of any given group, with a stronger role for the group supervisor overseen by EIOPA. The bill applies to almost all EU insurers and reinsurers. Only the smallest ones will be exempt, and even those can choose to opt in. This is a harmonization and consumer protection measure in European Union terms. As the preamble to the original directive puts it, it is in the interest of the proper functioning of the internal market that coordinated rules be established relating to the supervision of insurance groups and with a view to the protection of creditors to the reorganization and winding up proceedings in respect of insurance undertakings. As a transposition measure, the bill is required to follow the provisions of the directive and to transpose them into the laws of the Baltic. As a result, the bill is one of the longest disregarding consolidation bills to be brought before our Parliament. After a series of many delays over the years, the backstop date for commencement to the directive is the 1st of January 2016, and that is therefore the default date for commencement of the bill. The bill deals with the following main topics following the order of the directive as amended. Part 1 sets out the general rules on the taking up and pursuit of direct insurance and reinsurance activities. Part 2 contains specific provisions for insurance and reinsurance. Part 3 deals with group undertakings, and Part 4 sets out the rules about the reorganization and winding up of insurance undertakings. Although the bill is itself far from short, it is important to note that much of it is enabling and will be supplemented by yet further implementing rules to be made by the European Commission. In many areas, those rules will set out more detailed requirements for individual insurance undertakings as well as for groups. Finally, it may be helpful to note that the European Commission expects to review the solvency capital requirement by the end of 2018 and to report by the end of 2020 on the functioning and stability of the European insurance market and other high-level impacts, including the availability and pricing of long-term insurance products, that these may give rise to the need for further legislation. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put a question, as any honourable member which is speaking of general principles and management of the spring. I now put the question in the terms of the bill moved by the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Banking, and which I read out fully at first reading, and therefore I ask honourable members to agree that it has been read. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Financial Services Insurance Companies Solvency II Directive Act 2015.
I accept the event the committee chosen third reading of the bill to be taken today with all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree the committee stage on third reading of the bill to be taken today?
Committee stage and third reading. The honourable chief minister.
I have the honour to move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills called by clause. The referendum bill 2015, the electronic commerce amendment bill 2015, the university of the Gibraltar bill 2015, and the financial services insurance company solvency II directive bill 2015.
Does the Honourable Speaker for which to respect now, or are we continuing?
I think I would propose that we continue through the committee stage of the side, so it's not going to be long, and then the
the Bill for an Act to govern the organizational and administrative and procedural matters associated with the holding of referenda in Gibraltar. Clauses 1 and 2. Stand part of the bill. Clauses 3 to 6. Stand part of the bill. Clauses 7 to 9. Stand part of the bill. Clauses 10 to 13. Stand part of the bill. Clauses 14 to 38. Stand part of the bill. Clauses 39 to 42, stand part of the bill. Clauses 43 to 48, stand part of the bill. Clauses 49 to 60, stand part of the bill. Clauses 51 to 79, stand part of the bill. Clauses 80 to 83, stand part of the bill.
It's here that I have given notice of an amendment after clause 82 to introduce a new clause 84. Of which notice was given last week, and I understand the circulation of the members, which means part 11 referendum was out to stand, and then referendum was out to stand 84, where a result has been declared in the referendum conducted in accordance with the fact that result will be recognised, and as the second function may require, be given effect to until the result of the subsequent referendum is followed by the others.
Is any other member wish to speak on the treatment of the amendment? I then put it to the vote, those in favour. Those against, carried, closed.
I'm sorry, it's a belief that the honourable member is right. Because I've given written notice earlier of the new clause before, I think what I propose to do, and I will follow up with written notice if Mr. Speaker will allow me, is to propose the deletion of the subparagraph A in clause 3. So the subparagraph B no longer needs to be numbered D, and it all reads as one sentence, as we indicated at the second meeting, and I give the clerk written notice that he has it for his meeting.
I'll put that amendment to the vote. Those in favour, those against, clause 3, I think it is, as amended, stand part of the bill. I will now put clause 84. Clause 84, all in favour, those against. Clause 84, stand part of the bill. The long title, stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to amend the Electronic Commerce Act. Clauses 1 and 2, stand part of the bill. The long title, stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to establish the University of Gibraltar and for connected purposes. Clause 1. Stand part of the bill. Part 1. Stand part of the bill. Clause 2 is amended.
The Honourable, the Minister for Education has given notice of a number of amendments that have been speculated, all honourable members have seen. So I think we can dispense with the need for him to read those amendments. Probably?
Mr. Chairman, there is one additional amendment. I understand that. Clause 23.1.
We can get up to clause 22 and we can make a reference to that amendment. Can we call out on the clause we spent up to 22?
Part 2. Stand part of the bill, clause 3-4. Stand part of the bill, part 5. Part 3 is the problem. Stand part of the bill, clause 5 is amended. Stand part of the bill, clause 6. Stand part of the bill, part 4. Stand part of the bill, clause 7. Stand part of the bill, clause 8 is amended. Stand part of the bill, part 5 is amended. Stand part of the bill, clause 9 is amended. Stand part of the bill, clause 10 is amended. Stand part of the bill, clause 11 is amended. Stand part of the bill, clause 12 and 13. Stand part of the bill,
Clause 14 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 15 to 17.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 18 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 19 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 20.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 21 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 22 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 23.
Mr. Chairman, a proposed amendment is being distributed to deal with the honourable, the point of the honourable Speaker Caruana. The amendment is to the power to remove a member of the board. I'm not sure whether all honourable members have copies.
I think it was speaking with all the other clauses under
I understand it already now. There are a couple of amendments to the letter itself, which we've just done in a moment and passed over. It should say, I propose to move the following amendments to the University of Gibraltar Bill 2015 rather than Act, and then maybe to remove the existing clause by Section 23, and in place thereof include the new clause. Where there is a reference in the proposed new clause to the Board of Governors, I propose that to be amended and be replaced simply by a reference to the Board with a small d, because that's a defined term in the bill. So whenever it says of the Board of Governors, it should simply say of the Board with a small d. For some reason, in the letter that has been circulated, there is a number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 beside A, B, C, D, E, and F, which shouldn't be there. And I said, specifically the clerk. And then at the end, where it says, member of the board to be vacant, and thereupon such office shall become vacant. I would propose that we put a full stop there and remove the reference to publication in the Gazette, because there is no need under this particular bill for any publication in the Gazette in the first place. So let us just remove those last words.
Honourable members in agreement with those minor amendments?
That's part of the bill. So we now go back to clause 22. All those in favour of the amendment moved by the Minister of Education, as it were, carry clause 23 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 24 as amended,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 25 to 27,
stand part of the bill.
Clause 28 as amended,
stand part of the bill.
But a statutory body and no public notice of appointment seems to give them. How do people know who are from time to time directors of the university, or members of the board of the university?
Again, Mr. Speaker, I would expect that notice of the board be part of the website of the university. The university will have its website. It should have a provision on who the board members will be, and once the board is constituted, there should be a provision made in the website to give public notice of the members of the board.
Yes, I think that's
said before, it's a little bit too late to expect the honourable member to act in this as well. But I mean, given that these are people that enjoy specialty in unity from speak, I think it can see perhaps it ought to be more formally presented. I mean, people that have specialty immunity from civil action can't be just website up and do. But anyway, it's a problem of something today perhaps in the States. Can we give consideration to that valid point, Mr. Speaker? Because what we don't want to do is, when we're talking about a very independent body, actually create the nexus that the government is going to give its name, etc. So I think the opportunity is right to suggest that perhaps there needs to be something beyond just the fact that their names will be on the website, and they will be probably on a board at the university and all the rest of it, but that there should be some other public reflection of appointment in a way. Perhaps directing the Chancellor or the Vice Chancellor to make a public notice in some way, announcing it in a local newspaper and elsewhere, but not necessarily the Gazette, or directing the Chancellor to put it in the Gazette, but not the government. So if we could consider that, perhaps we can come up with a better solution.
Clause 29 is amended. Stand part of the bill.
Clause 30 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 31 and 32 to be deleted.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 33 to 34.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 6 is numbered as part 7.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 37.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 36 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 7 is numbered as part 8.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 37 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 38 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 39.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 40 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 41.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 8 remembered as part 9.
Stand part of the bill.
Clauses 42 to 44.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 9 remembered as part 10.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 45.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 46 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 47.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 10 remembered as part 11.
And as amended.
And as amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 48.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 49 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 50 and 51.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 11.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 52 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 53 to 54.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 55 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 56 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 57 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Remember clauses 32 to 58 and 31 to 56.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
A bill for an act to transpose into the law of Gibraltar provisions of Directive 2009/138/EC of the European Parliament and of the Council in the taking up and pursuit of the business insurance and reinsurance insolvency II and the provisions of Directive 2014/51/EU of the European Parliament and of the Council amending Directives 2003/21/EC and 2009/138/EC and Regulations EC number 1060/2009, EU number 109594/2010, and EU number 109594/2010, in respect of the powers of the European Supervisory Authority, European Insurance and Exploitation Pensions Authority, and the European Supervisory Authority, European Securities and Markets Authority, and related matters.
And the Honourable the Minister gave notice on the 17th of March, to me, which has been circulated to all members, of a few relatively minor amendments. Do all honourable members agree that have been read and can be incorporated? Very well.
Clause 1 to 3.
Stand part of the bill.
Part 1.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 3 to 14.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 15 as amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 16 to 46.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 47 is amended.
Stand part of the bill.
Clause 48 to 64.
Stand part of the bill. Clause 65 is amended. Sign part of the bill. Clause 66 and 76.
Sign part of the bill.
Part 2.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 77 to 100.
Sign part of the bill.
Part 3.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 101 to 141.
Sign part of the bill.
Part 4.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 142 to 172.
Sign part of the bill.
Part 5.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 173.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 174 as amended.
Sign part of the bill.
Clause 175 to 179.
Sign part of the bill.
31 paragraphs 1 to 8.
Sign part of the bill.
Paragraph 9 is amended.
Sign part of the bill.
Paragraph 10 to 60.
Sign part of the bill.
32, 3, 4, 5, and 6 as amended.
Sign part of the bill.
The long title.
Sign part of the bill.
The Honourable Chief Minister.
Speaking of the Honourable report for the Referendum Bill 2015, the Kent Commerce Amendment Bill 2015, the University of Gibraltar Bill 2015, and the Financial Services Insurance Company Solvency II Directive Bill 2015 have been considered in committee and agreed to with amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and from.
I now put a question, which is, that the Referendum Bill 2015, the Electronic Commerce Amendment Bill 2015, the University of Gibraltar Bill 2015, the Financial Services Insurance Company, Company Solvency Second Directive Bill 2015, be read a third time and passed, since there has been no indication of the opposition being against any of the bills. I don't think there is any need to vote for them individually. So I now propose that they be read a third time and passed. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Backbencher has got the attention of the Minister for Education and made a suggestion to me, which is, I confess I am going to accept my discussions with the Leader of the Opposition and here and I are entirely in agreement and of one mind. Today, Mr. Speaker, we know that four bodies have been found where apparently life has been extinguished in violent circumstances. It would be improper to say more. But the bodies are four British citizens, and two of them are children, apparently of a very, very young age indeed. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, I think we all agree across the floor of the House that given those circumstances, which are, thank God, unusual, in Gibraltar, indeed, an absolute and utter aberration, today's not a day for us to be playing political gladiatorial games in the motions that we were about to consider. And I'm therefore going to move, first of all, that we have a minute's silence as a result of this tragic finding, and second, that we don't proceed today into government and the British Nation, but that we adjourn to Wednesday at 5 p.m. to deal with those issues then. And I now move that, Mr. Speaker, that we move a minute's silence.
Mr. Speaker, too often people think of Parliament as places where there is huge political conflict, and often it is right that there should be. But today, those who have tuned in to watch conflict and that type of exchange have seen this Parliament do perhaps what it does best, which is for both sides cooperating to produce better legislation for our people. And I now move that on that note, we adjourn until Wednesday at 5 p.m. to deal with government and opposition motions.
The House will now adjourn until Wednesday, the 1st of April at 5 p.m. Those in favour? Aye. The House will now adjourn until Wednesday, 1st of April at 5 p.m.